giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. I'm Ben, and I'm here today with my buddy Derek. Hey, Derek.
Hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm in a unique state of mind.
Yeah?
Yes.
Change is in the air?
Change is in the air. That is what this episode is going to be about. So I alluded to this last week that I had some news to share. Yep. And here is the news for everyone. I am leaving Thoughtbot. It's been 6 years. It's been just about. It's been six amazing years. But I've decided it is time for me to strike out on my own and try doing my own thing for a bit. I'm not sure, honestly, if I'm going to like it or if I'll be any good at it. But I do feel pretty sure that I have to try it. The way I've been putting it to people recently has been, I know I want to try running my own company before I die. And I don't know when I'm going to die, so I'm going to try running my own company now and see how it goes.
Sound logic.
Yeah. And timing-wise, it feels good. I am single. I have no kids that I'm aware of. So it's kind of like, if this does crash and burn, it hurts no one but me.
Yeah.
I'm reasonably employable, so if it doesn't work, I can fall back on the job market, and that's fine too. Yep. But that feeling had been kind of building in me for a while. And tried some things here and there, and it just kind of felt like at the end of the day, I was like, I think I just need to try this. I just need to make this change and then see what happens.
Yeah, was there a moment when you knew that you wanted to do this, or was it a slow build?
It was definitely a slow build. Yeah. MicroConf helped, I would say. Not shockingly, when I was floating this idea to friends of mine at MicroConf, who are mostly like bootstrap entrepreneur types, I'm like, hey, I'm thinking about doing my own thing. And everyone was like, yeah, dude, definitely. It's like, of course, like as you might expect from that
naturally.
From that group. So I think that helped me over the line. But I would say it's definitely been a slow build. It's not that I've been unhappy, but I have had that growing sense of maybe it's just time for this. Like maybe I like big change and I like new things. And I had been thinking like, okay, I either need to do some sort of big change at Thoughtbot, or there's also this other big scary unknown over here, which is maybe the big change is that I'm not going to be at Thoughtbot. So I gave my notice. I talked to Chad last week and announcing by the time this goes out, everyone at Thoughtbot will know, although technically everyone does not know at this point, but it's going to be public news quite soon.
You've been at Thoughtbot for 5 years, you said?
Yeah, actually, so it'll be six in like a couple more weeks.
Six, okay. So that had to be a tough conversation. How did that go?
It actually went really well. So Chad sort of said he understood. He was like, it's disappointing, but I get it. And that's kind of what I expected. Like, I didn't expect him to be super surprised. Yeah. Thoughtbot in general has always been super flexible about letting me work on the things that excite me and have ability to sort of design my own job. And so I think maybe he was a touch disappointed that I didn't want to try to work more within that framework. But it just, which I get, but also it just felt like it was time to try the full thing.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, response has been pretty good. Like it's great. Like we were just talking today, and like it feels like we still have the same good relationship. And so
yeah.
It's like it's disappointing, but I think everyone involved understands.
It's a good feeling to know that you know obviously have not burned any bridges, and it's you making progress, I think, in your journey. So it's, man, I gotta say, I'm super excited for you.
Thank you. I'm really excited too. I don't think I can tell how it's gonna end up. Like I wouldn't try to predict how it's going to go or what's going to happen, but it feels to me like this increases my luck surface area, where I'm trying to be really aggressive about reaching out to people and talking to people and meeting folks, and I think it's likely that there will be a good outcome from this that is not what I'm anticipating. Like it feels like this is in the right direction, and I bet I meet someone along the way or a company or something clicks in some way that I can't anticipate right now, but I just feel optimistic about it working out pretty well.
Well, I think that's the right attitude to have, because if there's one thing I've learned in any entrepreneurial journey is that you cannot even predict what's going to happen in 60 days, probably. You know,
right.
You can have plans, you can test things in the market, you can validate things, but really it's going to come from trying stuff, you know?
And totally.
I would love to hear more about some of your next steps.
Totally. So I have two things that I'm pretty confident I'm going to do and I'm going to work on. So there's roughly kind of like a two-phase plan mm-hmm. here. And then, like you said, predicting even 60 days out is difficult. And so yep. who knows? It could be that by the time people even hear this episode, these have changed.
Sure.
But maybe not. So I asked myself, what is a good first couple things to try to do? Mm-hmm. And I can't remember who said this. It may have been Justin Jackson. But it was something along the lines of, it's easier to build a product for your audience than an audience for your product.
Mm.
And I think I already have a bit of an audience that trusts me on two-ish things. One, mm-hmm. or knows me as someone that cares about and thinks about and has experience in two things. You are smiling because I think you know these things. So one is SaaS pricing.
Bingo.
yep. And the other is Vim.
Double bingo.
Yeah, 2 for 2. So yes. Given that I already have some momentum in those areas, what kind of products could I make for the people in that audience?
Mm-hmm.
So before I made this move, or like all along, I've been saving money just because like I'm a fairly diligent saver, I guess. And I was just kind of like, I don't know yep. when I'm going to need this money, but I figure it's better to have a pile of money in an account anyway. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I figure it out. And turns out it's for this.
Yep.
So that's nice to have. I have a good bit of runway. Probably a couple of years if I am frugal, but I don't really want to burn that money on groceries and rent and things like that if I don't sure. have to. I would rather think of that money as ammunition or you know like resources to spend on growing a business or making a business better that's going to throw off its own revenue as opposed to I bought some milk this week.
Right. You want to deploy those funds and invest them into your company and not just pay the bills with them.
Yeah, not in my fat tissue.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So the first order of business is to hopefully kind of stop the bleeding, basically. So my income is going to go to zero in not very long. And so I have a burn rate. And how do I cover that burn rate? And my first answer for that is on the pricing side, which is basically stolen right out of Patrick McKenzie's productized service playbook. And so here's the pitch. If you are a B2B SaaS company and you make somewhere around 30K and up per month, you probably have a lot of high leverage work that could be done by running some pricing tests, like maybe changing the pricing, maybe jiggering what your value metric is or what features yep. show up in what tiers. And you probably have a hunch that you should do this and that there is low hanging fruit there, but you probably haven't done it. Mm-hmm. I think most people set their pricing sort of emotionally early mm-hmm. on by like, what would I pay? And they go and they work on their product like crazy and they work on their marketing like crazy. And the product gets better and the market, the people signing up often change and the pricing stays the same.
Yep.
At the same time, I think there's low hanging fruit there in general. And also it's such an effective lever. Like it works really mm-hmm. well when you go after that low hanging fruit, which has basically been like my trick for the last like year and a half or 2 years has mostly just been doing that. And it's worked pretty well for us.
Yep.
So my pitch is your B2B SaaS app needs a part-time chief revenue officer. And that person's job is to own the pricing page because mm-hmm. technically probably the CEO owns the pricing page, which means that no one owns it because the CEO is focused on product or team or keeping the lights on or a million other things.
Yep.
And so my job as your part-time CRO is to make sure that we are continuously running pricing tests and talking to customers and coming up with buyer personas and trying different packaging and different numbers and running split tests basically to say, look, here is the current pricing page. Based on my research and my knowledge and some black magic gut feel, here's the new mm-hmm. one. And over the last 2 months, here was the incremental difference in MRR added. And if we took that out over a year, here's your ROI on paying me.
Yeah, I think that's really compelling because it is the ROI is so clear. You know, it can mm-hmm. be computed. It's not like, yeah, we've made your product incrementally better.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you actually measure that? You know, this is actually measurable.
Yes.
And you can point to prior instances of you doing this with things you've worked on where you can, you know, give actual percentage increases in revenue or whatever. And
yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, see that spike in the graph right there? Like, that's me doing this thing. Like, and it's yep. it's right there. You can see we went from X to 3X or 2X or whatever.
And it's crazy. There's examples like this out there, like GitHub, I think, raised their prices or redid their pricing model maybe a year, year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so in their basically first 8 years of existence, they had like a $7 plan because that's mm-hmm. what they came up with, you know, on the first week of breaking ground on the code base. You know, mm-hmm. it was like crazy how long they stuck with that.
Totally.
And it was just like, yeah, we've been meaning to change that, but you know, they right. got to a massive size and still didn't change it.
So. Totally. And if you're a runaway success like GitHub, that's probably fine. But
sure.
if you're not, and a 10% or a 20% difference in MRR could be the difference between profitability and not, like yep. that becomes a much more critical thing.
Exactly.
So my theory is that there's a market there and that I can do a good job and service that market and prove ROI, like you said. Like, it's right in the revenue path, which I love about
yep.
it. It's like,
yep.
if this does or doesn't work, we will know exactly by how much. Mm-hmm. And I can give you a report every month that says, here's your ROI so far and here's your ROI expected over the year. So that's what I'm going to start with.
What have you done so far to do like early validation of that hypothesis?
So I've just been talking to a bunch of SaaS company CEOs, mm-hmm. friends of mine that I know, and just pitching a lot of people on that idea. And so far, response has been really good.
Great.
No one has said that they don't think it's a good idea, although maybe that doesn't happen with ideas when you pitch them to people.
Yeah.
I run it by a lot of people, and the response is generally pretty positive. So a number of people have said, that sounds great. Like, I want to put money in the budget for this, and let's talk in 3 months. Mm-hmm. I have one verbal yes from someone I've talked to, which is definitely not a signed yes, but it's, you know, a good sign, positive indicator.
Right.
So, yeah. So it's early days. I would say this is very much not a validated idea, but it's showing early signs mm-hmm. of life. And the good news is, like, this doesn't have to work. If this doesn't work, it's okay. The goal of this is, I think I'm going to enjoy it. Like, yeah. I would love to work with the MicroConf crowd. I would love to find a way to have those people be customers and to like get into their business and learn more about it and have a positive impact on that.
Yep.
And so I'm hoping it works. And I think if it does, I will like it. But I don't suspect it's going to be a long, long-term thing. Mm-hmm. But again, so many hand-wavy variables here.
Sure.
But the point is, if it didn't work at all, that would be okay. Because the real point, I think is probably the phase two idea, which is the Vim thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to hear about the Vim thing?
I do, yeah. Okay.
So my theory on the Vim thing is that there are a lot of people that are professional developers that want to learn Vim, and they are either intimidated or they are concerned about how much productivity hit they will take to do mm-hmm. it. So they're a professional developer. They want to learn Vim. They are actually convinced of its benefits, probably, let's say, but they can't afford to be unproductive for 3 weeks at work.
That's learn. Pretty much me, man.
All right. Excellent. Perfect. We'll call it. This is our first customer validation call then. Or not the
Carry
first.
Carry on.
But yeah, I have you so far. Good, good. And also, I think, by the way, some of those people have tried already and failed. Mm-hmm. So they gave it a shot and it didn't work. And so I think there's a market opportunity there because I hear from a lot of people that either want to do it but can't afford the productivity hit or tried to do it and could not handle the productivity hit or got stuck in some way.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. to me, there seems like a gap in the market there. And so my plan is to create a Vim course where, let's say, it's a month.
Mm-hmm.
The first week is set up and learning the basics of Vim. So mm-hmm. there's actually a fair amount to getting a Vim set up and configured. What plugins do you use? Which plugins should you not use? Should you use Janus? Mm-hmm. By the way, no, you shouldn't use Janus. What needs to be in your Vim RC? Should you use someone else's Vim RC? By the way, no, you shouldn't. You should mm-hmm. use your own, but make it really minimal. So there's a lot of ways you can go wrong, I think, before you've even started learning.
Yep.
Then you need to learn the rudiments, like how do you open a file? How do you edit a line? How do you get basic things done? Say that's the first week. Maybe it's the first 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Where the rubber meets the road is when you actually start using it at work, when you have to get work done and Vim is your editor. And so my plan is for that phase to offer live support in a Slack room to people mm-hmm. during business hours. Because I've chatted with a lot of people that failed to learn. And what almost always happens is they say, I knew how to do something in Sublime or Atom, and I wanted to do it in Vim, and I couldn't figure it out. So I Googled it, and I didn't find the answer in the first couple minutes. And so I said, screw it, and I went back to my old editor.
Mm-hmm.
And so my hope is, if you keep people from getting stuck and you help them learn how to help themselves too along the way, you will maintain their progress and they will stay using it and they'll get through that painful part. And so that productivity hit can be way, way, way less.
Yeah.
So my theory is with like a good prep before you try to use it at work, we make sure you know what you're doing roughly. And then when you are at work, you have like immediate support to get you unstuck when you are, then we can take that success rate and like triple it.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really compelling because that's my biggest, we talked about it before on the show, but like that's my biggest concern is like my time is valuable mm-hmm. and You know, anytime I spend fiddling around or trying to, I mean, the worst is trying to Google a command for something because it's like, you know, there's like colons and characters that are probably being, you know, escaped by Google or ignored or something. So it's like, yeah, that's the trickiest part. So
totally. Yeah. Well, I'm glad it sounds compelling. I didn't realize you might be in my target market.
I mean, perhaps. I mean, I guess my biggest objection would be that I think I know the benefits of Vim and I'm beginning to become convinced that, you know, maybe not lifting my keys off my keyboard is going to actually save me time and help me be more productive. But I'm not sure I'm like fully over the fence. I just happened to be at a meetup the other day and there were some Emacs users in the room and they're like, you know, show of hands, who uses what editor? And then even some of the Emacs users were saying like, yeah, I only use it because I've been using it for 20 years. But if you're like just learning an editor, like there's no reason to. So I guess that's the, and like a couple people in the room agreed that like, yeah, there's no reason to use an older editor if you're just learning one from scratch. And I thought that was there's not much meat to that argument because it's like if you dig into the why, I mean, you can start getting into the benefits of, you know, a console editor versus a GUI editor.
So that's a reasonable objection. My theory is that there are already a number of people that are convinced and I can kind of start there. And so I think in the beginning, I will focus less on convincing people that Vim is great and rely on the fact that it already has some cachet and reputation among people, rightfully so, I think. But longer term, I think I'm going to have to convince people like you that are on the fence. And so I have an interesting idea for that. And again, I'm talking like a thing that might be months away. So who knows if this will ever happen. But here's my thought is I want to prove that Vim is faster because I'm pretty damn convinced it's faster. Mm-hmm. And so I have an idea for a series of videos where I basically go head to head with users of other editors.
I like it.
And it's like, here's some Ruby code. First one to make it look like this Ruby code or refactor it in this way wins. And we both record our screens and then I can sort of do a post-game analysis of like, okay, here's where you lost a couple seconds by taking your hands off the keyboard to move over to the mouse to click this thing. And here's how modal editing helped me get through this section faster, things like that. So
would you do that live? Would you like go on, was it like Twitch or something where you can
no, I don't think, I was
like
picturing,
live
you know,
stream
like,
stuff?
No. I was picturing like, you know, edited versions and that way I can cheat and speed it up in post and make it look way better.
Oh, okay, there you go.
Yeah. No, but I think I actually can like put my money where my mouth is, basically, and show people that Vim is really great. It's very fast, and that by using a non-modal editor, you are probably costing yourself like somewhat substantial time.
I like it.
Thanks. So those are the two ideas, and that is what I'm going to be focusing on over the next handful of whatever time.
Nice. So I had a few questions to throw at you. One of them being, what are you most excited to learn through this process? Because obviously you've learned a lot at BotBot, getting to run products and, you know, at least play the founder role of products. So what are you most excited to learn?
How to get health insurance.
Ah.
No, very technical. Yeah. So I feel like I have been able to use the ThoughtBot brand and existing audience as a bit of a crutch, honestly. So I would say that my marketing skills are honestly probably pretty weak, or they're probably the weakest of my skills. And I have some audience now, but I think a lot of the success behind ThoughtBot's products are that we just have been doing insane amounts of effectively content marketing for 12 years and doing great work
there.
Yeah, big flywheel. And so I'm curious, I'm interested and curious and excited to see, can I do that when I don't have that advantage?
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest thing. That's one thing. And I'm going to flip that question too, which is like, what am I worried about? Because why not? Let's focus on the negative for a second.
That was actually my next question, is what scares you the most?
Okay, yeah. The thing that scares me the most, honestly, is, and I feel like very lucky to say this, is it's not the financial success, because at the end of the day, my safety nets are very strong.
Yeah.
I can get a job. I think that's always
right. Highly employable. Like even if savings were to go away.
Exactly. Yeah. And I would get a job before I even like depleted the savings all the way. You know, like I wouldn't want to get down to the wire. So I'm not worried about myself financially. I'm honestly more worried about myself socially, interpersonally. So I'm very extroverted and I like working on things with people. And so the idea of being a solopreneur does not really appeal.
Yeah.
And so both those businesses are probably solo efforts, more or less. And that's why I think I've been having like a phase 3 in my head, which is now like hand waves on top of hand waves on top of hand waves. Like, I can't even pretend I can commit to this, or like that this is even a fully formed plan. But I'm kind of hoping is that by running a couple businesses myself, and assuming the CRO thing works out, seeing a lot of other people's businesses, I'm going to keep my eyes open, because I would love to get back into SaaS. I'm sort of happiest in that space. Mm-hmm. So get back into a thing where I'm writing, probably writing code, maybe not writing code directly, but you know, running a subscription revenue business, and hopefully hiring people, like building a team. So I think my dream scenario is come across an idea that looks good, validate it, start building it, prove it out, maybe raise a tiny bit of money, and hire my awesome friends.
Yeah, I think that's a solid plan, and I think it's wise to not necessarily jump straight to SaaS. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels like in the community, especially, like that's especially in the last few years, a lot of folks in the MicroConf community and stuff have been kind of putting SaaS up on a pedestal, like that is the pinnacle of businesses to achieve. But then there's also the other side of it, where that famous Gail Goodman talk, the long, slow SaaS ramp of death, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, you know, growth can be tough. And you look at these other types of businesses where it's whether it's productized consulting or some kind of info product or course or something like that, and you can get to sustainable revenue in months. So mm-hmm. I think it's a great classic stair-stepping approach plan that you're taking.
It's straight out of the Rob Walling stair-step playbook. Yeah. It's funny. I actually did a call with Rob to like sort of run him through my plan, and he was like, "Yep, that stair step. It sounds about right." He's like, "I'm not saying that just because I'm like Mr. Stair Step, but like this is kind of how I go after this." He's like, "Don't start with the SaaS."
Yep.
So yeah, I think it's kind of like a nice way of de-risking it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have plans for combating the loneliness of solo foundership in the next year?
I do. I have a couple things. So one is I'm actually going to be going to Hong Kong for a little bit. So by pure coincidence, a really good friend of mine quit his job to start building his own thing as well. Mm-hmm. And we're very close. And he was like, "Hey man, like as of this date, I am now unemployed and working on my own thing." And I was like, "You're kidding, because like me too." So I'm going to probably spend about a month in Hong Kong with my friend, like in a co-working space together, just like cranking on stuff. Nice. Because I think both those businesses that I've said so far, I need to build and like work on building an audience around. Like I need some content, like pillar pieces of content that prove I'm an expert in those things and a decent mailing list and things like that.
Yep.
So I think I have a lot of writing ahead of me, and I can do that anywhere. And doing it with my best friend in a fun foreign place sounds like taking advantage of that whole like work from anywhere, you know, internet entrepreneur thing.
Oh, absolutely.
And helps combat that loneliness thing. So I have an answer for 1 month of the next year.
There you go.
In general, though, I'm just going to try to be really aware of it and do things to try to fix it. So I'm going to be touring co-working spaces in Boston. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking for... It's funny, like if you look at reviews for co-working spaces, they always talk about like conference rooms, Wi-Fi, staff friendliness, and snacks. And I'm just like control effing for the word community. Because I'm not looking for an office space. I'm looking for other people that are also working on interesting things and want to be friends. And want to get lunch and want to, you know, talk about stuff and whiteboard things occasionally and whatnot.
Yep.
So I'm trying to say yes to all kinds of invitations and reach out to my network and schedule calls with people and join a mastermind and like just set up a lot of social support, basically.
Yeah. Nice. Sounds like a good plan, man.
Yeah. We'll see. That is honestly the part I'm most worried about. So I'm hoping I can kind of address it. But an interesting thing is I sort of ended up isolated a bit here at ThoughtBot already. So like the team sort of shrunk and I'm working with people that are mostly remote these days. And I've been chatting with my like coworkers, fellow ThoughtBotters at like lunch and like a one-on-one once a week. But I actually am kind of already dealing with that isolation now. And honestly, I think that's one of the things that pushed me in the direction of making this move was like, yeah, the isolation sounds like not my jam, but I'm kind of already paying the isolation tax.
Yeah.
And so why don't I try doing this myself if I'm going to do it anyway?
Right.
So I want to keep talking about that. Also, I'm co-hosting this podcast with this guy named Derek. So that'll be another one of those social
touch points. Who's that
joker? Just this guy. He's really tall, though, so I have to be friends with him.
I can rival you on height, that's for sure.
Yes, exactly. I'm only friends with people that are pretty close to the tall side.
There's a joke about the drip team too, because we're a tall bunch that there's like a 6 foot height requirement to join the team.
Interesting.
May or may not be true.
Almost certainly illegal. Be careful what you say.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned earlier writing code, and
yeah.
I was curious to find out what your how you see your relationship with code changing
yeah.
in this next phase.
Yeah, I don't. So, like, I probably shouldn't write any code for these upcoming like the first two things I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going deep. Here's my so I don't know. I can't decide. So let's say I did have some success with those first two businesses and also came up with an idea for a SaaS. And it was time to like actually like break ground. I think it's easy to say like you should be the CEO now. You got to give up the code thing.
Yep.
Hire someone great for that, and you know just accept that that time is behind you. But that just sounds kind of crappy.
Yeah,
like
I agree.
My favorite nothing puts me in a flow state like writing code.
Yeah.
And so the idea of doing that just doesn't. I feel like I'd be building myself a job I wouldn't want.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
I share your sentiment. You know, in trying to picture like, all right, down the line, if I'm doing another thing,
mm-hmm.
do I want to be, because this is the classic transition that a lot of folks make, right? Where mm-hmm. you start out, you're writing your own stuff, and then you graduate to being the marketer and the business person and not touching code.
Yeah.
And totally valid path, right? But like you, I get a lot of joy out of the creative aspect of writing code. I know you can be creative in other areas. Like you can think of a well-executed marketing campaign as creation, and it definitely is.
Mm-hmm.
But it varies person to person on whether that's actually going to give you the rush that you need, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And my hypothesis is that it is possible to be a CEO or a person running the business who also has their hands a little bit dirty, at least in actual product.
Yeah.
And I surely hope that that's the case because,
yeah,
because that's kind of what I picture for my future, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's like, it's really handy to be able to write your MVP yourself.
Yeah.
I think that's a big advantage, and iterate quickly yourself, you know, like you're talking to the customers and then you can just go write, make those changes. Like that's powerful.
Yeah. There's very little distance between, you know, the one side of your brain that's taking in the information and the other side that's writing the code. And
yeah.
It's difficult. I mean, it's not impossible, obviously, but it's difficult to get that level of efficiency
mm-hmm.
when you, from day one, you're trying to transfer knowledge between a whole team.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Like it's funny because I also don't want to just be technical.
Sure.
Like, I don't think I would want to be someone else's technical co-founder and just like where my part of the business is just the code and the product.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not right either.
Yeah.
But I guess I think that's the beauty, honestly, of being in charge, like, is that you get to decide, like, I'm 40% development and 60% the rest or something. I think. Maybe that's like a recipe for disaster. I don't know. But that's sort of where I see myself.
The fun thing about my role at Drip from basically the beginning is, you know, I definitely did start out as like, I'm just writing the code, you know, and that's mainly what I'm doing. And then as time has gone on and the product has developed, you know, Rob and I work really great together on product decisions. And I never probably would have labeled myself a few years ago as like a product visionary or whatever, but like, I really do feel like a lot of the value I add to the company in general is kind of thinking about product and where, what direction to take it, what features to add, what things to not add.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily an engineering role. You know, so it just so happens that I do engineering and also do the product thing. You know?
Yeah.
And I think if it was purely engineering and I wasn't doing any of the product thinking, I wouldn't be fulfilled.
Right. Yeah. Same.
So
for sure.
You may find that like, oh, I'm actually doing product. And without that part of it, if I was purely just writing code, it's, you know, it's not all there.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, it sounds kind of like your position is roughly the right mix.
Yeah.
I think I would want to be even probably a little bit less on the like marketing side of things, and I'm not sure what the right balance of things is.
Yeah,
but code needs to be in there, product needs to be in there, marketing probably, not sure, but that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, is like, do I have to give this up? I hope not. I don't really want to.
Yeah.
I think you can, like, so Natalie Nagel, I think is how you're saying her last name, who was on this podcast once and ages ago, by the way, gave a talk at MicroConf, and she put up a slide at one point, which is like, what kind of business do you want to run? And there were like 12 questions on there. And she was like, make sure you think about these things. And they were good questions and I liked them. And she sort of stressed the point that a lot of these things are variables. You don't have to build a company the way that someone tells you you do.
There's no one right way to do it.
Totally. And so like, there's probably a strong case to be made for like, don't write code, you're the CEO. But I think there's also a strong case made for like, man, if you can also write code, that's a big advantage. And you can translate that feedback directly into things. And you can run a development team really well because you're still technical and you haven't gotten out of touch yet. And
yep.
I think there's a legit path in there somewhere that satisfies me.
I do too. I think there are companies that have a certain DNA in them, you know, and it's a, you know, a company that's started by marketers is going to probably have a really strong marketing DNA, and may their weakest spot might be in product development or engineering. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the flip side is true too, where you could have a product whose DNA is primarily product driven, engineering driven,
right,
and has learned the skill of being able to market that product.
Yeah.
And
both could work.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I like it. So it's a new chapter. I'm pretty excited. By the way, if you know somebody or you are somebody that thinks that part-time CRO sounds good, you should email me, ben@benorenstein.com.
Boom.
Boom. That's called marketing right there. If you are somebody that might be interested in that Vim course, if you go to vimuniversity.com, there'll be a little thing where you can fill out, or there will be by the time you hear this.
Nice domain.
Thank you. There's also vim.university, which I thought about buying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I think I like Vim University. I like the .com. It's so legit.
It is.
Yeah.
I feel like the alternative extensions are getting more and more mainstream. Give it another maybe year or so. You know.
Sure. Yeah.
Vim.guru.
Vim.guru. Yeah. Someone suggested Vim.kitchen, which I also really like. Like the Vim Kitchen. I think that's like very playful and approachable.
Yeah.
Like come to the Vim Kitchen
and we'll use the cookbooks.
We'll mix up a little something.
There you go.
But Vim University is what I'm going with for now. So.
I like it.
If you head there, there'll be a little form. You can drop an email, and I'll tell you when this thing is ready and what's going on, and also share like my process. I want to be working in the open a lot during this, expect a lot of me in the interactions. But there's more change in the air, which affects you and me, which is this is a Thoughtbot podcast, and you don't work for Thoughtbot, and in 8 days, I won't work for Thoughtbot either. And so after 239 episodes, I'm retiring as host of Giant Robots.
Oof.
Yeah.
It's heavy stuff.
It is heavy stuff. It's been an amazing journey, as they say.
Yep.
I never dreamed I would do hundreds of these when I started it. I remember Chad asking me, and it was like just pitching me, and I was like, yeah, this sounds good. Let's try four and see how it goes. And here we are like 5 years later. And that's kind of amazing.
I think at one point you remarked to me that this is perhaps the thing you've done for the longest in your life.
Yeah. Right? I would say other than like programming and singing, I think this is like my longest hobby or not hobby, but you know, activity. So next week I'm going to be joined on the podcast by Chad, and Chad is going to be taking over as host, and we're going to have a lot more details about what the podcast will look like, but it'll be different and it won't be you and me actually.
Yep.
But if you are interested in continuing to follow the Ben and Derek saga, which I think is about to get a little more interesting, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are spinning up our own podcast.
Yes, indeed.
And we don't know what that is yet.
lots of TBD being thrown around.
There's a whole lot of TBD in this episode, but I wanted to get the information out there such as it is.
Yep.
And so our plan for this next week is to come up with a name and a website and all that. So when I'm on my final episode with Chad, which is the next one that you will hear, I will be able to point you to the new podcast, or a new podcast, the one that Derek and I will be on, and also hand over the reins to Chad and hand him the baby and let him take the wheel and go, and other metaphors.
A good mix there. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel a little emotional, honestly.
Yeah.
It's
understandable.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would love it if people continue to listen, and I'd love to stay in touch with all of you.
As would I. And I want to say a public thank you, Ben, for inviting me on this podcast back in August, I think, of last year.
Has it been? Wow, it's been just about a year. That's crazy.
Yeah.
You're welcome. I'm glad you did it. It's like, I think you were a tremendous addition to this. And it, not all the 239 episodes were the same amount of fun. The ones with you were a lot of fun. So.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've come out of my shell a bit. And gotten outside of my comfort zone, which is, I guess, part of what you're doing in your next phase here. So
yeah, so let's keep doing it and talking, and next one we'll let you know where you can find that.
Yeah,
awesome. Wow, so much news,
so much change.
Yeah, but and in case you don't make the transition and don't want to subscribe to another podcast, you're like, no, I'm into Giant Robots as a URL and that's the only thing I'm interested in. Thank you to all of you. I've been humbled by the response to the podcast and how many people say nice things on Twitter and in person, and how funny it is to have people recognize my voice and have us laugh about that.
And are you that guy from Giant Robots Podcast.
it's been awesome, and like people are so nice to me on the internet, which is crazy. Like people say so many nice things, and they usually are saying nice things about this podcast. And so thank you so much to everybody who has listened over the years. It has honestly been a pleasure and an honor to be in your earbuds each week.
Indeed.
I think that's where we should wrap it up.
Let's wrap it.
Thanks for being on this podcast with me. It's the last one with Ben and Derek. Okay, yeah. All right, I can handle this.
I know. It's hard to, yeah.
It's hard to sign off. But
it
is. But I'm going to do it. And we're going to look towards new pastures as well.
To be continued, ...
TBD. And I'll be talking to all of you one last time next week. And I'm looking forward to that. So today's show was produced by So Tom, and thanks for all the fish, Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/239. Thank you so much for listening.